Welcome to another episode of Extinction Radio, recorded live in our virtual global studio. Today's broadcast will have interviews with Dylan Thompson and Karen Strickler, along with our featured segments with Carolyn Baker, Gail Zawacki, Benjamin the Donkey, John Compost Gresham, along with poetry readings by Deba, Kale Earnshaw, and Rex Eagle. Of course, Gene's Gems will feature two of my favorite songs. I would like to sincerely thank Mike Farragan for his vision and hard work in making Extinction Radio happen for the first 24 episodes. Mike has retired as producer, and Ivy Cohn, Peter Melton, and myself, Gene Gibson, are now co-producers. This episode will also be co-hosted by Carolyn Baker. So without much further ado, Extinction Radio episode 25. I'd like to introduce our first segment. Ivy Cohn will be interviewing Dylan Thompson.
Welcome to Extinction Radio. I'm your host, Ivy Cohn, and today's guest is Dylan Thompson. Well, Dylan, thanks for being with me today.
Thanks for having me, Ivy.
Well, your claim to fame in the most recent years is as the co-founder of Fertile Ground Institute, Environmental Institute, and an activist in environment and social justice, I believe. Yeah. So what is at the top of your list right now?
Top of my list is the same thing that's been there for the past 5 or 6 years that I've been politically active, which is climate change, mostly. The death of the planet and the ecological foundation of life as caused by human activity, and more specifically industrial civilization. So that's really been my focus, and that is sort of the umbrella under which a lot of other smaller struggles have been occupying my time, whether it's indigenous resistance to colonial imperialism, or pro-feminist work, helping women in their struggle for liberation against patriarchy, other social justice work, and then local eco-justice campaigns. So a lot of stuff going on, but the umbrella is climate change and what this culture is doing to the planet as a whole.
That really is the overarching picture.
Yeah.
And that human activity that has, in both the social and economic, as well as the destruction of the climate that followed on from that, that human activity has brought us to this current state of dire affairs.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Before we launch into a little chat about, you know, extinction events, can you just share how you personally, you know, from your early young life came through to be to this place?
Sure. I mean, I can only really guess as to what factors really pushed me in the direction that, you know, made me end up where I am right now. But the way I'm thinking about it today is just, you know, I grew up in a rural part of Western Washington State on 5 acres with a lot of animals. My parents really liked to get, you know, we had a menagerie of different critters growing up. And so I think that non-human relationship, even though it was a domesticated human, domesticated animal relationship, you know, that teaches you something about non-humans. But beyond that, across the street from my parents' property was a meadow, which was home to many wild animals that I spent a lot of time watching and listening to, whether it was elk, coyotes, foxes, bobcats, deer, you know, a whole ecosystem was going on across the street. And I really do feel like that was a large part of my priming to be an activist, I think. And then it never really found expression in terms of, you know, I never felt the need to speak out about what this culture was doing, mostly because I didn't know what this culture was doing or the extent of the damage. And I went through high school as a normal-ish kid. I liked reading books. And by the time I got to college, I started to have some sort of anti-establishment sentiment, so to speak, I think, because I liked, you know, beat poetry from the 50s and got into a lot of music from the 60s and 70s and started learning about the culture back then and, you know, anti-establishment resistance movements, you know, the movement against the war in Vietnam and a lot of the student uprisings that went on back then inspired me to start thinking about things differently. And when I got to college, I met some folks who put some books into my hands and that really, really changed things for me. And I think I have anthropology to thank for really steering me in the direction of becoming anti-agriculture and anti-civilization in the end. Particularly the book Ishmael, written by Daniel Quinn, fit in with what I was learning in my cultural anthropology class. Learning about the ways that humans have lived on this planet. You know, for 99% of our existence on this planet, we were hunter-gatherers. You know, we were subsistence farmers. And as many stories as I was told growing up about how that life was brutish, short, primitive, not as good as the civilized way of life that we have, I started learning things that contradicted that story. And even in a university anthropology class, I was learning that the average hunter-gatherer works 20 hours a week. And that work is difficult, sure, but it's going out with your family and friends to hunt and to you know, make a garden and get what you need to survive. And, you know, that just led me on a path of different books and talking to different people and reading science and news and looking at what's going on in the dark corners of the world. You know, who's making the clothes on the backs of the people who are walking around me? Oh, I learned that it's mostly sweatshop labor in so-called third world countries. You know, what's going on in these places that are, you know, not what I was used to? And so I went through a process of radicalization and realized that there are a lot of problems in the world, and they all seem to stem from the same root, you know, because we didn't always have bombs, we didn't always have mechanized warfare, we didn't always have sweatshops, we didn't always have slavery, we didn't always have the levels of rape that are in this culture. So it was just kind of an organic process for me, and I fell in with the right people and found a group of people who we're kind of going along the same educational journey, and that's kind of how it happened for me.
And here we are in the middle of the sixth great extinction,
mm-hmm.
which is a direct result of the human endeavor.
Yeah.
It sort of took a left-hand turn back there somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did.
And you know, the planet has had a number of extinction events.
Mm-hmm.
Five notably that are often found on the charts.
Right.
And 250 million years ago was the Permian extinction, which was also called the Great Dying, still is called the Great Dying,
mm-hmm.
because it took out, you know, up to 90% of everything.
Right.
And then 65 million years ago we had, you know, the dinosaurs, which was a result of the earth warming and, you know, the Siberian traps and the lava and et cetera and
right.
so on. So. You know, that was a biggie.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another smaller one at 55 million years that doesn't have any particularly significant attributes that bear on this.
Mm-hmm.
But now we are in the sixth great extinction.
Right.
And this is pretty common knowledge now among people who are paying attention.
Yeah.
And it's getting some airtime out there in the general media as well.
Mm-hmm.
So how does this extinction perhaps differ in your ponderings
mm-hmm.
from the others?
I think it differs in a big way, because, you know, the name for this current extinction that we're in that I've heard over and over again is the Anthropocene. They're calling it the Anthropocene, and that prefix anthro means people, humans. So it's, even in that name, it sort of implies that this is a human-caused event, extinction event. Despite that, I hear a lot of people talk about extinction, you know, this extinction and the previous extinctions, sort of lumping them together, saying that, well, extinction happens. Extinction is a natural thing that happens on the planet.
And to a large degree, this is an accurate statement.
Oh, it is, and I actually 100% agree with them. But then we have to talk about what does natural mean, because it's natural for me to be sitting here talking to you because we're both people and we both came from this planet, you know, and it would also be natural if you got angry at me and decided to hit me in the face right now, you know. But just because that might be natural doesn't mean it's good if you want a mutually beneficial relationship. So I don't think natural versus unnatural is what we should be talking about. I think what we should be talking about is what we as creatures want on this planet, and what the planet wants as well. So do we want to live here in the future? Do we want humans to have a future, let alone other creatures, the creatures that we're driving extinct with industrial civilization? And I think that should guide our question. We shouldn't get bogged down with, well, this is natural, therefore, throw up your hands kind of thing. We don't need to do much. So
that seems to me, that attitude, to be it's not my problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's a natural event, which takes that responsibility factor out of people's minds.
Exactly. Right.
And I think that whole mindset has been perpetrated, of course, over the centuries upon the domesticated population that we are.
Yeah. Yeah, and I personally think about this. It's an ecological issue. And, you know, we as bodies are ourselves ecologies. We have our internal ecologies. And when we get sick, you know, we have these intelligences within us. White blood cells, our immune systems have their own intelligences that know what to do when we have a fever, you know, when we get a virus or an infection or something. Our bodies respond. That's responsibility. Our bodies have their own responsibilities. And so I think my work over the past 5-6 years has been trying to inspire an immune response, basically, in the human population, to something that I perceive and the people who I work with perceive as sort of a disease. Sure, it's natural, unnatural, whatever. I don't really care about that. What I care about is that something happened 10 to 12,000 years ago that sparked an antagonistic relationship between human culture and nature. And I love humanity, personally. I think humans are beautiful creatures. I also think that wolverines are beautiful creatures, and black rhinos are, and elm trees, and I don't like that this culture is destroying all of these lives, all of these communities. So therefore, I think the appropriate ecological response of humans right now is to form an immune response to dismantle the mechanisms of that disease.
So I would just like to try to reiterate that.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that humans might be considering is developing an immune response to the dominant paradigm culture that has wrecked this havoc. And that kind of an immune response, as you pointed out, you know, our immune systems have an intelligence of their own. So in cultivating an immune response to the dominant culture, we can nurture that innate intelligence that is perhaps there to resonate with that.
Yeah, I agree with that. Talking about natural, unnatural, it feels like if you use your whole body to respond to this, you use your brain and your heart, and it does take courage, I think, in this world, because it's scary. You know, it's scary what's happening to the planet, and it's scary what could happen to you if you decide to fight back. Because once you learn about the problems that are going on, and you learn about the interests behind keeping things going the way they're going, you know, you look at the money, you look at corporate enterprise, you look at capitalism. The system needs things to continue the way they are, despite the fact that climate change might destroy everything and they wouldn't be able to function anyways. It's a scary endeavor to actually form a resistance, to form that immune response. So, but I think it's the human thing to do. That's what I come to these days.
Well, given what we're facing, Dylan, it's scary to think about what's going to come down, possibly, mm-hmm. and very probably, mm-hmm. In terms of the, you know, I mean, we're in a mass extinction event.
Yeah.
That includes humans.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be very pretty. Mm-hmm. And it terrifies me, mm-hmm. frankly. I have children, grandchildren. I don't feature the notion of, you know, I also live in the west coast of North America, which means, you know, I'm big fires this year. I can
right.
be burned out. I mean, all those things really do kind of send a chill down my spine.
Right.
So if that is a given, why not encourage my immune response
right.
and take a stand and resist and, you know, do everything I can to perhaps have some species with enough living members to be able to carry on through this.
Right. Yeah, that's the question, isn't it?
And that really does cause me to take courage
mm-hmm.
and to really fortify myself to face every day
mm-hmm.
what we're up against.
Right. Yeah. There's a quote I love, and I never remember the man's name who said it, but talking about, I believe, the forest home that he lives in, and I believe it's the Amazon rainforest in Brazil. You know, I am the rainforest fighting back, you know. And it was something like that, and I think we need to embody that kind of mentality too, which brings us to the topic of identity and loyalty, you know. And this is, when I walk around here, what I see mostly is a remaining loyalty to the system, which is understandable because the industrial economy gives most people their access to food and water and shelter. And if industrial culture gives you those things, it's natural to want to defend that thing that gives you those things. But what we're trying to do, and what I've been trying to do, is just try to inspire that sort of forethought of, yes, this is the short-term gain that we have. The short-term gain is that we are going to continue to get what we need to live. The long-term loss is that the system that gives us those things is undermining the ecological framework which is supporting that very system. That system needs healthy forests and healthy prairies and oceans and, you know, a living planet, basically. But it's taking that all away, which means we can't. It's a dead end. It's a dead end road. So the challenge then is to form a movement that has as its goal long-term gain, which might mean short-term loss because it will entail giving up some of those current systems or changing them in some way that make them not harmful. So.
Well, and those systems are not going to, they're not sustainable,
right.
obviously, and they may collapse sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
For me, looking at that, knowing that it could be next month, 6 months, where, you know, my bags of stored rice may be the only thing that my family has to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Just accepting that as a reality in my possibly near-term future
mm-hmm.
has helped me to be able to decolonize my mind
mm-hmm.
and heart a bit from that dominant paradigm and the systems. Yes, I'm benefiting from it. Yes. It's allowing you and I to sit here and do this.
Yeah.
But I know it's going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that it's going to go away has allowed me to spend more time cultivating a resonance with living systems, which,
right.
you know, watching bugs crawling on rocks is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Listening to the birds.
Right.
Noticing when there are fewer birds.
Right.
Noticing that there are no young hawks.
Mm-hmm.
I drive up and down, commute basically the I-5 corridor up and down the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I would count somewhere between 60 and 80 hawks
mm.
of various ages
mm-hmm.
in that 450-mile drive.
Right.
In the last 3-4 years, up to present, it's just been a steady decline, mm. steady decline. And in the last 2 years, I have seen maybe on a trip. 2 years ago, I might have seen 3 or 4.
Yeah.
This year, last month, I did not see one hawk, and no babies.
Right.
So noticing and actually being in resonance with these living systems as they're going extinct, mm-hmm. with what's left, rejoicing with the mama squirrel who's got baby squirrels coming out of the, whatever it is,
right.
to nurture that resonance with the living system is, in my opinion, a big piece of the developing of that immune response that you're so brilliantly have called it.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. And I also don't think we should shy away from the feelings of despair and pain and sadness that being in tune with all of these losses will inspire in you, because that is the basis of action. One thing I do a lot of is looking at other movements in the past. You know, what have other people done when they've been faced with desperate situations, whether it's the people in South Africa when apartheid was still in existence, or the resistance to Nazi Germany, you know, these overwhelmingly horrible situations. What did people do? They took that despair and that pain and suffering and being pushed into a corner, and they turned it into action. Not everybody, but resistance movements are birthed out of that kind of soil, the soil of necessity. And what's difficult is trying to get near-term extinction and the results of climate change to be that kind of impetus for fighting back. And the losses of our non-human neighbors, you know, should that, in the ideal world, that should be enough. We should have our loyalty, in my opinion, should be with those hawks and with the prairies that are going extinct. And, you know, talking about driving up and down the I-5 corridor, there are no bugs splattering on the windshields anymore. And that's because the wetlands are all being destroyed. And
we won't even get into the number of dead and dying trees and vegetation of all types, the parched and cracked soil. This catastrophe is fully upon us at this point.
Yeah.
And it's not just here. It's global.
It's global.
It's global.
But we're made of matter, and those things are made of the same stuff. That when we all came from this same dirt, you know, and I just think that fighting, you know, the only thing to do in a culture that is taking, you know, sending these creatures and beings off into the longest night of extinction, the only thing to do at this point for me and personally is to fight back. And there are a million ways to do that, but I think the fight has got to be there.
Do you feel, my observation, and perhaps you would feel the same way, is that people who are looking at our dire situation go, mm-hmm. well, why bother?
Right.
Let's party on.
Yeah.
In whatever form that may take in their world.
Yeah.
Because it's pointless, it's going to go extinct, so who cares? That also is a shirking of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yes, this is happening, but if you don't do something,
mm-hmm.
then there may be no life systems left.
Yep, exactly.
And so, you know, finding something, I often ask people, you know, with all of the unraveling that we have going on, you know, what is the one thing that brings you to your knees and tears to your eyes?
Right.
There's your passion.
Yep.
Do something in that arena.
Right.
It doesn't matter if it's teeny tiny.
Right.
It takes all of us.
Mm-hmm. I totally
doing
agree.
Doing something.
Yeah.
Doing something.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. What I say to the sort of let's just party until it goes out is to go back to my metaphor earlier about our bodies being ecologies. You know, we're going to die someday. That's pretty obvious. All of us die. But in the meantime, I hope that my immune system fights back when I do get sick, and that the individual cells that partake in that resistance don't just throw up their hands and say, well, this body's going to die someday, so why fight?
Why bother being a white blood cell?
Exactly.
So I actually am going to start thinking of myself as a white blood cell in the earth system.
Right.
Yeah. Because that's kind of what you're talking about.
It is. It is. I think that attitude, a shirking of responsibility, yes, and also a really sad indication of the disconnect, that we don't identify as earthly beings anymore, that we are, that separation between human culture and nature is really a huge gap in order for somebody to say something like that, like, yeah, it's just party, you know. I feel very sad when I hear that, because I don't think the connection to this beautiful planet isn't there.
No, and that is something that the dominant cultural paradigm over the last 10,000 years has really worked hard at achieving, is mm-hmm. a separation
right.
from the natural rhythm of living systems.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you see as being a mechanism or a tool or an avenue for people to get from that disconnected place back into a connected, honoring space with life?
Yeah. I think you touched on it, honestly. I think if you find something that brings you to your knees and brings tears to your eyes, that to me is the earth, is the source coming up through you and tutoring you into what you should be doing. And, you know, maybe your passion, maybe you just can't bring yourself to cry about the loss of the salmon or the loss of the passenger pigeons darkening that used to darken the skies for days at a time. But there's got to be something. There's got to be something that keeps you going. And if you can find that and think about it, you know, think about where these things come from and just spend some time. I think that's a good start. But I also think that capitalism and this culture has done a really good job at making us feel powerless. It's made us feel powerless by making us feel that the solutions can only be achieved on an individual basis, which is why you can talk to most people today and they think that riding bicycles and shopping at your local organic natural food store is kind of the extent of environmental action. Sure, there's protesting, sure, there's writing letters to your Congress people or whatever, but that's a very, very low level of political engagement. And like I was talking about before, apartheid was met by resistance movements, people who were in the above ground dealing with politicians. Simultaneously, people in underground networks of people were sabotaging industrial equipment of the apartheid regime to get them to listen to the people who were going into office. And we haven't exhausted all the possibilities of resistance yet until we've made a movement like that,
yeah.
You know? So...
Well, and in fact, I think that movement is... It could hold huge more numbers of people.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps as the embracing of this notion of, well, if we are going to die sooner rather than later, I think I'm going to do something. I'm going to sit with these feelings of despair and grief and just embrace all of this so that I can move forward with action. Perhaps then more people will come into play mm-hmm. with a real resistance.
Yes.
And as I said earlier, I could be out of here next week, which mm-hmm. is why I'm sitting here with you today doing this
right.
and get it out to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right up to the last moment
mm-hmm.
to be engaged with that resistance to the dominant paradigm. Just, well, I love the way Chris Hedges puts it. I mean, we can extrapolate from this comment. He says, I don't fight fascists because I'm going to win.
Right.
I fight fascists because they're fascists.
Exactly.
And, you know, I don't continue doing what I do as a media producer and a bug watcher
mm-hmm.
because I think I'm going to stop the dominant paradigm. I'm going right. to do it because there is a dominant paradigm.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I love that quote by Chris Hedges.
Yeah. So it's given me a lot of comfort and inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Because then it points to something that, you know, I think the resistance does need to be happening right here, right now. And yes, you think about goals, you think about long term, you think about the chances you have, you think about how big the problem is and how big the culture is, and you can get overwhelmed that way. But if you want to be a white blood cell, and if you make that your being and who you are from fingertip to toenail, you know, I think you're not going to get burnt out as easily. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have the impetus to keep going forward.
And this ties directly into joy, mm-hmm. Which is a completely different animal than happiness. Mm. Joy has an eternal quality to it. Mm-hmm. And people often say, well, how can I find any joy in all this?
Right.
When you are in that place of acceptance and courage and doing action based on your passion, joy springs up here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Unbidden, you notice it.
Right.
And that joy is, I'm getting little goosebumps as I'm saying this, because it sounds so weird and like it couldn't possibly, you know, it sounds like an oxymoron. How can you be accepting all of this and be in joy? What? Mm-hmm. But they're very much related.
Yeah.
And, I think that you have really hit on it. It is that really letting this sink down into our being and honoring and loving life, mm-hmm. from a cellular level.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's so beautiful.
Yep.
I really hope that people can, as they hear this conversation, take a little time to really ponder the notion of developing their immune system,
yeah.
to the dominant culture.
Right, right. And I guess to sum it up, or the question that I would ask folks is to think about it in terms of loyalty, because the way I see it, there are two sides to me. There are the salmon being driven extinct, and there's that force that's driving them extinct. And while they may have come from the same place, industrial civilization did come from the earth too. But it is, like I said before, it has an antagonistic and a relationship with the earth. And so I think if we want to, if we're questioning where we want to be in the immune system, do we want to be a white blood cell? Really think about your loyalty. Where does your loyalty lie right now? Why does it lie there? What are the things that contribute to you being on the side of civilization versus the side of life, of the planet that's being killed? And really think about it. Just think about it with your heart and your mind, and then follow your heart from there.
Well, following our hearts, that's mm-hmm. a good place to wrap this conversation up,
mm-hmm.
Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
It has been really nice to sit mm-hmm. with you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me today.
And thanks to all you listeners out there on Extinction Radio for tuning in. I'm Ivy Cohn, and with me has been Dylan Thompson. Have a beautiful day.
You know, they say we're no smarter than yeast. They say we'll all soon be deceased. But we'll find in the rubble the end of the trouble. Any day now we shall be released. That's why I listen to Extinction Radio. Hee-haw!
Thank you, Ivy and Benjamin. And now for one of my gems, Chuck Mason, Procrastination.
Mama used to tell me I'ma miss her when she's gone, and I know that. Try to rewind time, but physically I can't go back. Having a hard time when the sun always sets, so I hug her every day that I will have no regrets. But the strangest simple fact is this world is backwards. Life's a feature film with impromptu actors. It's gonna be some real tears for it's all said and done, cause more often than not the mother buries her son. Not wishing death upon me, but reality assassinates the dream. I procrastinate, it seems like it's a catch 22. Don't win or lose, I guess the good Lord will ask me tomorrow to hit the snooze. And I wake up in the morning with the drool on me. Hop up in the shower, put the cool on me. I know the Jack boys is out, don't be a fool, homie. Yeah, OG's a carpenter, the tools on heat. Let's ride, let's coast to lie. And when you feel like nothing else, let's toast. Lift your glass, let's toast. Lift your glass, let's toast. Yeah, the high. we fly. Strong winds gotta touch the sky. Means the harder we fall. Even if I give it my all, I'll be part, but it's always tomorrow. It's always tomorrow.
The higher that we fly, the harder we fall.
These rappers say you lies of a life they never lived. Tell you they got cars in a state they never been. Then you turn around and play that shit to your kids. I mean, what kind of adult example is this? The only time they truth is in existence when they step inside the booth. Whole school buckets turn to Lamborghini coupes, and that old ass limps a chandelier on the roof. Cause they real talks, false and deception to the youth. To the brothers in the hood, moving that white enemy, trying to get a few K, no white supremacy. If you pushing dope, let me say I don't condone, but let the bricks build the edifice. Your house and not your home. The harm you do to others, it's gonna burn in your tux. You stand in front of God, know it's judgment, it's just. Failure's a state of mind from which I moved, I trust. So, with my old paths, I'll connect, I cut. Let's ride. Let's coast. Until I. And when you feel like nothing else, let's toast. Lift your glass. Let's toast. Lift your glass. Let's toast. Yeah, yeah, the higher we fly. Strong winds gotta touch the sky. Means the harder we fall. Even if I give it my all, I'll be part, but it's always tomorrow. It's always tomorrow.
The higher that we fly, the harder we fall.
But tomorrow's not for certain. And I bet nobody breathing on this earth is promised another minute, another hour, another day. Promised another second, bow our heads and let us pray. So, dear Lord, please forgive me for my sins. My misguided word approach to get these ends. Help me get this money with my friends, put this money with my fam. Pray my morals still guide me as a man. Seen it so close, the pride that dies within. From the signs they die over. Anguish, hate, and pain, and graves that mothers cry over. The stupid situations that we spend our lives over. No rewind for us to spend our lives over. No, sir, no. Cause the thing about life is it moves forward. In the event of our demise, moves toward us. Any struggle arises, just know that I'm ready for it. Every trouble in our past has been endured. Grab your coats and let's ride. Let's coast. To life. Feel like nothing else. Let's toast. Lift the glass. Let's toast. Lift the glass. Let's toast. Yeah, the higher we fly. Strong winds gotta touch the sky. Means the harder we fall. Even if I give it my all, I'll be part, but it's always tomorrow. It's always tomorrow.
The higher that we fly, the harder we fall.
Hello, Extinction Radio fans. It's time for your main interview. My name is Peter Melton, and joining me for this interview is Carolyn Baker. Carolyn, you there?
I certainly am. Can't wait.
All right. And today we get to talk to Karen Strickler, and she's out near Washington, D.C., and is playing in some of the political realms around the topics of climate change. Karen, are you there?
I'm here, and great to be here, Carolyn and Peter. Nice to talk with you both.
Hooray! We have magical technology that allows us all to have a little conversation here and share what's up with our new friends. So, Karen, instead of me trying to introduce who you are, why don't you tell us who you are, how you got to get to this point of passion around the topic of climate change, and a little bit of what you're up to with your Vote Climate Pack.
Sure. Thank you so much. I would probably describe myself as a lifelong grassroots political activist. And that started for me in the women's reproductive health sector. I was the executive director of the Maryland affiliate of the National Abortion Rights Action League, where in 1989, when regulation of abortion was being returned to state legislatures across the country, we put the principles of Roe versus Wade onto our Maryland state law books. So we codified Roe versus Wade. In the process, we got rid of some old, what were called therapeutic abortion laws, which were a little ahead of their time, but they're gone. Now Maryland women are protected whether or not the Supreme Court decision in Roe versus Wade holds up over time. We did that through the legislature, then through the electoral process. We had to clean some house to come back to actually pass our bill. And once we did pass our bill codifying Roe versus Wade, it was petitioned a referendum by the anti-abortion forces. We beat them soundly in the end. And so Roe versus Wade is codified in Maryland. I moved from there on to lead the National Endangered Species Coalition, whose mission was to strengthen and reauthorize the Endangered Species Act. And, well, anyway, that's a long story that we don't need to get into, but the Endangered Species Act does remain unreauthorized to this day, and that's kind of a sad story about the political status of that. And, you know, I also founded in the interim an organization to train women in the campaign skills necessary to run for public office. One of my great accomplishments there was to train women in Botswana, Africa, how to run political campaigns. And in the election after our training, they doubled the number of women in parliament. And they also significantly increased the number of women in local council. I went on from there. Actually, you asked me how I started with climate change, and there's a very particular story around that. I wrote an article, an essay called The Do Nothing Strategy, and it was an expose of progressive politics in America. And a guy from Missoula, Montana, named David Merrill, contacted me and said, well, you know, we really like your perspective on things. The idea is that well, it's a long story. People can Google the Do Nothing Strategy and read about it, but basically the idea is that it came from my experience in the abortion rights movement in Maryland when a woman, actually when the regulation of abortion was being returned to state legislatures, she stood up and she said, we're going to spend endless hours, thousands of volunteer hours, hundreds of thousands of dollars, but our goal is to do nothing. And she had this detailed on flip charts, and I thought this was just the most absurd thing I had ever heard. And I stood up and said, I'm codifying Roe versus Wade for the state of Maryland. You have two choices. You can either join me or you can eat my dust. And the rest is history. I mean, we did codify Roe versus Wade, but back to David Merrill, who said, you know, I really like the way you think. Have you ever thought of working on climate change? And I said, no. And he said, read the book, The Heat is On, by Ross Gelbspan, a former columnist for the Boston Globe. And I read that book, and it really turned me around to a point where I began to understand the issue both, you know, a bit on a scientific level, on a political level, and I started getting more involved with the issue, and ultimately had my own local cable television show called Climate Challenge Media. It was out of Kensington, Maryland, and it was the first and only TV show in the nation that focused exclusively on climate change and related issues. And I had that show for 5 years, and I interviewed some really interesting people, and through that process learned a great deal more about climate change and all the related issues, and everything is related to climate change, as it turns out. And so that was a real education for me, and something that I'm really glad I took the time to do and to learn a whole lot more about the issue. And ultimately, what I learned was that what we need is a political solution to climate change. And I thought, well, okay, so I'll wait and see if anybody does that. And nobody did it. Nobody did anything for a very long time. And so that's how Vote Climate US PAC came to be.
Wow, so you have just some amazing background in fighting some very difficult fights.
Yes, so I always like to take on the tough ones. I call them some of the most divisive issues of our time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm a good person to take on those kind of fights because, I don't know, I don't believe in compromise on really important issues. That's not to say, you know, I don't believe that there are a lot of ideas that need to be taken into consideration, but fundamentally, for example, with reproductive rights, you know, I did not believe that women's reproductive rights should be infringed upon. And, you know, the same way I believe we need a political solution to climate change. And, you know, I can talk more about Vote Climate US PAC if you'd like.
Yeah, why don't we do that?
I mean, because I was just wondering, like, what do you mean by a political solution? So if you could be more specific, that would be great.
Yeah, we'd all love to find a solution and are eager to hear of possible solutions that are lurking in our midst. And so, yeah, tell us about your Vote Climate US PAC.
Okay, well, let's be clear that the term solution is used loosely in this case because we're far down the road into a climate emergency, and we haven't used the time since we've known about the climate emergency very well at all. In fact, we haven't done anything meaningful on a political level to slow climate change. So the mission of Vote Climate US PAC is to get off fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas, transition to clean, renewable energy, and to put a price on carbon in the form of a federal carbon tax. With the goal being, I mean, the most recent assessment of the International Panel on Climate Change, their fifth assessment report, said that no later than the end of the century, we need to be down to zero carbon emissions. And there's only one way that that's going to happen. And, well, maybe two ways. Through federal carbon tax legislation in the United States of America, and through binding international treaties that bind the participants to very particular diminishment of carbon pollution over time. You know, I mean, I can't do a whole lot right now about the international picture, but I can start to organize to pass a federal carbon tax with the goal of dramatically reducing emissions, and hopefully over the next century, I guess up to a century, bringing them down to zero. There are others, of course. There are other professors. There's a professor at Penn State. I think it's Petra Schackert. I think that's her name, who says we need to be down to zero carbon emissions by mid-century. And my feeling is there's no way that's going to happen without a federal carbon tax that compels polluters to pay for the pollution that they're creating, thereby giving them incentive to bring down their carbon emissions quickly over time.
Right, and that's kind of the interesting game we find ourselves in here, is that most people, when they hear about the emergency that we're in, are called to some kind of action for themselves. You know, sometimes the doomers are portrayed as people who have no hope or are offering that know that there's nothing to do. But what we find mostly is that people get incredibly fired up with the urgency of our situation and want to do something, want to express their humanity in some way. And the political possibilities are one strong angle that people want to take, but then so many get frustrated. Karen, how do you look at the history of our politics and have any hope that we're going to be able to make a political change?
Let me just say first that if people want to find out more about the organization, they can go to voteclimatepact.org. And our website is really, really developing into a nice resource for people to both learn about the issue and to take action. And how do I have hope? I have hope because, you know, I know what I was able to achieve politically on the state level, and understand that it's a big leap to the federal level to make that kind of change. But my hope really lies with the American people. You know, I can't tell you how many times, every day probably, I hear people say, oh God, Americans are so stupid. And I have never, ever bought into that. I believe that the American people are smart and that they're practical, and that when they're given proper information, they will make the right decision. And so, you know, maybe that's ridiculously optimistic, but it's my faith is definitely not in politicians, and that's why I started a super PAC, because I believe that we need to replace a lot of politicians. And, you know, politicians operate on two principles, fear and greed. So I'm not afraid to try to strike some fear in the hearts of climate change deniers, or those that should be and just are not leading the climate movement toward a federal carbon tax. And look, recently, Resources for the Future and I forget which prominent collegiate institution, Stanford, I think it was, did a poll, and they discovered that 67% of the American public supports what's called a revenue-neutral carbon tax. And that's a carbon tax where the revenue actually goes back to the taxpayer. So polluters are taxed, And that revenue is actually sent in the form of a check back to citizens of the United States. 67% of Americans support that. There's another name for that besides a revenue-neutral carbon tax. It has sometimes been called a fee and dividend. And, you know, we have huge, huge public support for that right now, and it's only increasing. And so I believe that the American people, with our help, the help of Vote Climate PAC, Vote Climate US PAC, are going to make, to pressure the politicians to make the necessary changes. Let's face it, politicians rarely, if ever, lead in our country. It's the people who lead. And I believe that people are getting to the point where they're going to start to demand that federal legislation be passed for climate change. It's never happened in the United States. No federal carbon legislation or federal climate change legislation has ever passed. You know? Right.
And that's one of the exciting things as I look into the future. It's like, okay, how would we want it to be? We want people to become aware that we're in an emergency. Believe it, what you want. You know, is it a 5-year emergency? Are we already in the emergency? Is it 50 years from now? Regardless of that, what we're urging forth is this movement of people who realize we're in an emergency and can begin to act and talk about and push their government and push their leaders to say, hey, we've got to do things differently. And that seems like exactly what you're up to.
Absolutely right on. That's right on, Peter. That's exactly what has to happen. And, you know, so maybe I'll talk a little bit about how we hope to make that happen. Is that okay?
That is okay, as long as Carolyn knows that she better chime in with a question pretty soon.
All right. Well, feel free, or I can continue, whichever you prefer, Carolyn.
Well, let me jump in. You know, last year I co-authored a book with Guy McPherson called Extinction Dialogues, and he did the science part of the book. And as a former psychotherapist, I did the other part of the book, which was how do we respond emotionally and spiritually to this awful, catastrophic situation? And yesterday, as I was preparing for this interview, I was looking at an article that was in Live Science last year entitled "America's Mental Health is Latest Victim of Climate Change." And the psychiatrist who's being quoted here, you know, she makes a statement: "This kind of anticipatory anxiety is especially crippling and is increasingly being seen among climate activists, in some cases rising to the level of a kind of pre-traumatic stress disorder." So I'm wondering if you can relate to this finding and how you cope with all of this emotionally. I know that you're really a doer and you certainly are taking action, but how is it for you emotionally?
It's really, really hard. I love that term, pre-traumatic stress disorder. That says
right.
It. That says it. And it,
yeah.
And it really is an issue for everybody who really comes face to face with the climate change issue and really begins to understand it. And that's why I take such issue with doomers, because you got to have hope. I mean, I don't mean to sound like Barack Obama, but, you know, if you don't have hope, you can't get out of bed every day.
Well, I'd really like you at some point to define what that means to you, to have hope.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I want to tell you, I've been down the road. I mean, I've been working on this issue for about 7 years now. So, you know, in one way or another, writing about it or doing a TV show or working on, you know, with climate groups, trying to help them figure out a plan. And believe me, I have had my times when I just feel broken down. I mean, I just feel so depressed that, you know, I feel like I can't move forward. And my message to people is, you know, yeah, you might go there, but you've got to get past that. And the way that I got past it was to get moving on doing something positive to try to slow climate change. And really, I mean, the thing that gives me hope is Vote Climate US PAC, because I feel like I can begin to do something which would really, if it succeeds, will really make a huge difference for the issue and could potentially slow climate change. And, you know, I mean, I know that's a big order. Believe me, I know that's a really tall order, but I'm a really tall woman. So, you know, I'm going to take it on.
Well, I admire your passion. I really do.
Yeah, and it does, you know, I think you point to a good spot there, Karen. And if you just joined us, Extinction Radio, this is Karen Strickler, and she has her passion in the climate situation is in the political realm. And while there's plenty of room to doubt what's going on with politics, there's also plenty of inspiration that can come there, that the only way we are going to make a change is for more and more people to be talking about it, more and more politicians to be learning about it and finding their voice and figuring out what we can do. And this big thing's coming up in Paris. What do you think about what the timeline between now and Paris, and will Paris be an inspiration to humanoids?
Well, let's face it, those international climate change talks have resulted in absolutely nothing to date. But there's a big but here, and that is, I think that the Barack Obama administration, you know, as a lame duck administration in the final years, I think they've taken a new approach and decided that they are going to make something happen on climate change. And believe me, I understand that his administration talks out of both sides of his mouth. While he's, you know, talking about the urgency and the emergency of climate change, he's opening up the Arctic to drilling. That's insane.
Right.
But I hope that, you know, I hope that he finally gets that you got to get off fossil fuels. That's why our mission at Vote Climate US PAC is to get off fossil fuels and to put a price on carbon. Now, in terms of December, I guess I'm, you know, it's really funny. I don't really think of myself this way, but I guess really I am an eternal optimist. My husband wrote a book called The Keys to the White House, also known as The 13 Keys to the White House. And it's a system for predicting presidential politics that was developed in 1981 and has never missed predicting accurately the popular vote on the presidential election. And he's having a hard time calling the keys this time to say whether it's the theory behind the keys is that presidential elections are referenda on the party in power. And there are 13 key factors which determine whether or not the party in power will be reelected. Five or fewer keys turned against the incumbent party and they win. Six or more turned against them and they lose. They are right now four keys down, the Democrats, that is, the only ones who are taking any kind of action on climate change at this point. And there are three keys undecided. So one thing that the Barack Obama administration and any Democrat or Republican running for president right now can do is take action on climate change. If, according to the keys to the White House, if the Obama administration gets a major climate deal, they could turn two keys in favor of the incumbent Democratic Party. That would be foreign policy success, and potentially, if a treaty comes home and has to be ratified by the Senate, it could also turn the policy change key in favor of the Democrats. So, what the Obama administration and anyone running for president of the United States needs to know right now is climate change could make the difference between success or failure in the U.S. presidential race in 2016.
Yeah, boy, you know, we talk about hoping for political movement, and yet you've got one whole party who's pretty much all against it or just all not going to do anything with climate change. So we have this Paris summit. We have the end of September and the ice melt. We have a whole nother year worth of weird weather all playing into the election that comes up next year. And wow, what an interesting time to be involved in all this.
Yeah, well, I said it early on in the interview, Peter, that it's going to require federal carbon federal climate change legislation in the form of a federal carbon tax plus a binding international treaty. Both of those things have to happen. And it's never too soon. We are in the midst of an emergency situation with climate change. We got to make this happen.
Whoosh. Yes, it really puts it back into our hands. You know, the idea that we can bring up the story. You know, so many people on this Extinction Radio and folks that are feeling the passion around climate change and abrupt climate change and the emergency that we're in, wanting to do something, wanting to feel like they have an outlet. Well, if you have any leaning toward politics, be sure to check out the voteclimatepac.org. And of course, there's all kinds of local ways that you can get involved if politics is what shows up for you when you feel your passion about where the earth is going.
I would like to add one caveat to that, though, Peter, which is very early on in my experience on my television show, Climate Challenge Media, I had a climate scientist named Brenda Eckwurzel from the Union of Concerned Scientists. She was my first guest ever, and she said, nothing short of a federal carbon tax is going to slow climate change. So if you get involved on the local level, that's fine. It's one thing. But her feeling was that without these mandatory, federal limits on carbon emissions, nothing is going to fundamentally change. So I would say, I mean, I understand the old adage about, you know, think globally and act locally. Well, in this case, it's think globally and act on the federal level, because that's where it's at with climate change. If you really want to do something important, help us pass a federal carbon tax.
Yeah, thank you for daring to be big enough to go to that level and to play at that level. It's a powerful topic, and like you say, I'll have you play it out. Let's stay with the theme of we're putting all the best of humanity forward. We realize we have to do something in the political realm if this is going to work. If climate change gets too big too quick, then there's nothing we could do anyway. So this is the other side of that coin that says, what if we do have a few years more than we're thinking we do, and we can begin to create something? What's this upswell going to look like? Play out your best case scenario, Karen, for us for the next 10 years.
My best case scenario. Okay. My best case scenario is that I'm able to raise the money, raise the revenue in order to make the PAC a power player in climate change. And therefore change the minds and hearts of those in the U.S. Congress, House, and Senate that represent us and pass a federal carbon tax. And that federal carbon tax is high enough, the amount per ton of carbon is high enough that it brings down carbon emissions and other greenhouse gases to the point where, well, to zero, so that we have a chance on limiting the rise in average global temperature and the related weather extremes of all sorts that are associated with that. That's my best case scenario, and we got to get there. I mean, let's make it clear. You know, doomers have a point. If we don't do something, we are doomed. And so the only alternative is to do something, and that something, in my opinion, has to be to pass a federal carbon tax. So that would be my best case scenario. I'd be, wow, if I achieve that, I will die happy.
that's terrific for the United States. How do you see this expanding? Because obviously the federal level is one level, but there's the global level that we need global participation in this predicament.
We do, and that's where the UNFCC climate talks come in. It's December in Paris. Again, the Obama administration and everybody who goes to that conference has to understand that we don't need voluntary standards, we need mandatory standards. And they have to be standards. I mean, you know, they talk a lot about 2 degrees Celsius rise in average global temperature being the absolute maximum that, you know, would still sustain human life on this planet. And there are many, many people who say that is too high, okay? And right now we are on a trajectory for, according to many scientists that I read, for maybe as much as 8 or 9 degrees Celsius rise in temperature. Let's just be clear, you know, that would mean the end of humanity. So these international treaties, I mean, I understand the 2 degrees. I understand that they got people to agree internationally that 2 degrees was the absolute maximum rise in average global temperature. All right, well, let's at least meet that target. Let's put standards in place that allow us to keep the average global temperature at or below 2 degrees Celsius, preferably below, because, like I said, there are a lot of scientists who believe that 2 degrees is even too much. So that's what we need to aim for in Paris. We need to aim for binding standards for every country involved, including China, including India, including the United States, that ultimately aim for 2 degrees Celsius rise in average global temperature or less, and preferably as much less as possible.
Carolyn, I want to ask you, if as you imagine the best possible scenario here, playing into this, we can get a groundswell of interest going in the political realm. It's a big enough emergency. Enough people's weather is weird enough that they're going to start paying more attention. What's the best you can see? What's your best case scenario, Carolyn, as we unfold these next few years?
I don't have a best case scenario. I guess I would be classified by our interviewee as a doomer because I don't see human beings being able at this point to significantly roll back, reverse, or slow down climate change, except in the case of the collapse of industrial civilization, that would certainly slow things down. Karen talked about the intelligence of the American people, that the American people are smart. And on one level, that's true. But there's also the factor of denial. This is not all about what we know and what we think. As I made very clear in Extinction Dialogues, the book that I wrote with Guy, that denial is such a huge factor in all of this. Whether you're the Koch brothers denying because you want to make lots of money, or whether you're just the average guy with a job at McDonald's who doesn't want his world disturbed for very good reasons. This is frightening stuff to really look at. And if you're going to take action, you got to really look at it. And very few people really want to do that. So the emotional piece is huge. People would rather watch the Super Bowl. They'd rather shop. They'd rather do anything but really look at what catastrophic climate change really means. So, and I was also trying to explain that my perspective is not one of doing nothing. My perspective is one of, okay, this is probably where we're headed. So how do we live lives of peace, passion, and purpose, serve other people, live compassionately in the world, make our environment as good as we can because it's the right thing to do, but not have the delusion that it's even possible at this point to turn things around.
Yeah, that's a strong stance and one shared by many folks. And I think that as I ask myself that same question, there's a whole part of me that believes just what you said there, that it's too late to significantly turn things around. But for those whose passion does lie in, well, I'm going to do the most I can with the time that I have.
Right.
But there's this balancing act of, and we've talked about this a couple different times, Joanna Macy's Active Hope speaks to this, is to put everything you've got behind what you're passionate about without being attached to the outcome.
Yes.
And I hear that in Karen's voice. Karen's no longer on the air with us, but thank you so much for being with us, Karen Strickler, that she wants to do the most that she can regardless of the outcome.
Yes.
And that in order to do that, she and many others need some picture of what is this most I can do. The most I can do is attempt to get some political movement going so that maybe we can slow this down, so that maybe we can buy ourselves a few more years, so that maybe we can have a massive groundswell of consciousness and intellect and right. earth wisdom, that maybe we could do something else that buys us a few years, that maybe we can do something that buys us a few more years. You know, that kind of passion does we want that to come out. And so thank you, Karen, and all you that are moved to present yourself in the political category. It's not my passion, but that doesn't mean anything else other than like you said, live a life of peace and purpose and passion. And mm-hmm. and in order to do that, I think we need to find that acceptance that this is a dramatic emergency time. We need to realize, what is my purpose? What's most important to me? How do I want my humanity to show up? And then to put the passion behind that purpose. And do.
Yeah, I agree. Everybody should express their passion around this as they feel called to do. And that's where she feels called to go. So I support her in doing what she feels she needs to do.
VoteClimatePAC.org. Karen Strickler, thank you so much for being on the show with us. And thank you to Extinction Radio listeners. Have a beautiful day. Thank you, Carolyn, for joining me.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter, Carolyn, and Karen. This is Gene Gibson, and you're listening to ExtinctionRadio.org. Now, Gail Zawacki will present her dispatches from the Endocene. Gail?
Thanks, Gene, and welcome, listeners. This is the 13th dispatch from the Endocene. Once a glimmer of awareness that a self-induced human extinction may be imminent first flickers into our consciousness, it seems inevitable for certain questions to immediately follow. Whether you come to this knowledge because you learned about amplifying feedbacks in climate change, or from a broader ecological perspective of overshoot, it often becomes urgent to understand why humans are so blind as to destroy our precious home, and whether things could have turned out differently, and how there can be any meaning to our lives if it's all going to disappear, with no one left to remember anything we accomplished or learned or loved. To address these issues honestly, it helps to have a realistic understanding of human behavior without distorting the past to accommodate the powerful desire that our better angels might ultimately prevail. An accurate reading of hardwired tendencies matters to the degree that it gets to the heart of why, even when we intellectually realize that our way of life is unsustainable and exploitative, still we are unable to stop ourselves from continuing down a ruinous path, a path that began to unfold long before civilization, long before agriculture. It has its roots in language and the use of symbols, imagination, and the potency of belief systems, abilities that bestow on the one species that possesses them to cooperate in large groups, whether for constructive or destructive activities. Despite the threat implicit to most people by the lack of free will, going through the process of understanding that we are fundamentally animals with genetically coded traits, like any other, can become quite comforting as one travels the road towards acceptance of extinction. The recent discovery of yet another vanished hominid species in South Africa simply adds to the roster of several others that were outcompeted, to put it politely, by our direct ancestors. I'm in the middle of a terrific book called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, by Yuval Noah Harari, that looks into how our minds evolved over time. I thought I would share a bit of it, where he writes about the short-sighted hunting by early hunter-gatherers, which led to results quite similar in kind, if not in scope, to the ongoing massacre of the biosphere by contemporary society. In substantiation of this, I will post links to some academic papers on this topic at the Extinction Radio website and also on my blog, Wits End, with a transcript. So here goes, starting on page 78. The extinction of the Australian megafauna was probably the first significant mark Homo sapiens left on our planet. It was followed by an even larger ecological disaster, this time in America. Homo sapiens was the first and only human species to reach the Western Hemisphere landmass, arriving about 16,000 years ago, that is, in or around 14,000 BC. The first Americans arrived on foot, which they could do because, at the time, sea levels were low enough that a land bridge connected northeastern Siberia with northwestern Alaska. At first, glaciers blocked the way from Alaska to the rest of America, allowing no more than perhaps a few isolated pioneers to investigate the lands further south. However, Around 13,000 BC, global warming melted the ice and opened an easier passage. By 10,000 BC, humans already inhabited the most southern point in America, the island of Tierra del Fuego, at the continent's southern tip. The human blitzkrieg across America testified to the incomparable ingenuity and the unsurpassed adaptability of humans, of Homo sapiens. No other animal had ever moved into such a huge variety of radically different habitats so quickly, everywhere, using virtually the same genes. The settling of America was hardly bloodless. It left behind a long trail of victims. American fauna 14,000 years ago was far richer than it is today. When the first Americans marched south from Alaska into the plains of Canada and the western United States, they encountered mammoths and mastodons, rodents the size of bears, herds of horses and camels, oversized lions, and dozens of large species the likes of which are completely unknown today, among them fearsome saber-toothed cats and giant ground sloths that weighed up to 8 tons and reached a height of 6 meters. South America hosted an even more exotic menagerie of large mammals, reptiles, and birds. The Americas were a great laboratory of evolutionary experimentation, a place where animals and plants, unknown in Africa and Asia, had evolved and thrived. But no longer. Within 2,000 years of the sapiens' arrival, most of these unique species were gone. According to current estimates, within that short interval, North America lost 34 out of its 47 large mammals, and South America lost 50 out of 60. Thousands of species of smaller mammals, reptiles, birds, and even insects and parasites also became extinct. When the mammoths died out, all species of mammoth ticks followed them to oblivion. Some scholars try to exonerate Homo sapiens and blame climate change, which requires them to posit that for some mysterious reason, the climate in the Caribbean islands remained static for 7,000 years, while the rest of the Western Hemisphere warmed. But in America, we are the culprits. There is no way around that truth. Even if climate change abetted us, the human contribution was decisive. I hope you get a chance to check out some of the research from archaeology and paleobiology upon which this excerpt is based, studies that are compelling to the unbiased. If you get a chance to read the book, Sapiens, I highly recommend it. And there is also a link to an interesting panel discussion about the Great Leap in cognition. There is a companion conviction to the discredited notion that it was climate, not humans, that caused mass extinctions over 10,000 years ago. And that is that tribal people before agriculture were peaceful, lived in harmony with nature, and were egalitarian. This popular notion, which bolsters the hope that our blatant exploitation and pollution of the environment was preventable and is the fault of a few bad actors, doesn't bear up to scrutiny of the actual record immutably buried in the ground. There are numerous examples, but to take just one I found recently, consider the Crow Massacre. Here's a summary of the wiki description. The Crow Creek Massacre site is in South Dakota along the Missouri River. It occurred around 1325 AD when a fortified village was attacked and at least 486 people were killed. Most were mutilated in various ways, such as tongues being removed, teeth broken, decapitation, hands and feet cut off, and other dismemberments, and most commonly, scalping. The remains of some of the victims showed evidence of previous battles, scalpings, and embedded arrows. And most were chronically malnourished, with stunted growth and nutritional deficiencies. It appeared that domesticated dogs were eaten during famine. To make matters worse by modern standards, a recent study of the markings of scalping wounds concluded that women were brutalized far more than men. And the reason is far more profound than competition for resources. The Crow males considered women more like beasts of burden, a subhuman source of labor Thus, they were dispatched in a method more like butchering animals than the symbolic ritualized dispatch of an enemy. So much for the noble savage nonsense. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week.
Thank you, Gail. And now a poetry reading by Rex Eagle and Deborah Kale Earnshaw. Thank you so much for your poetry.
This is a poem from Dark Poems Rising by Rabid Poet. The poem, Complexities. It seems so simple, things that we do, well thought out, so we pursue. They can become complexities the harder we push, but we must pursue them and join in the rush. Some see challenges, others see wealth, far from simplicity, affecting our health. Getting back to simple is not easy to do. In a hurricane of complexity, pursuing the new. There is no answer to this complexity game when simple and complex are exactly the same. This is another poem from Dark Poems Rising by Rabid Poet. Flee from reality. We watch the tube, smartphone in hand, texting simplicities throughout the land. Where should we go? What should we do? What should we wear to keep up with new? Who sang that song making us blue? Things going asunder, soon we are through. Try out that new car that will drive on its own. Just type in location and sit on your throne. And very soon, as insanity sets in, we fall down a rabbit hole, our dream to begin.
Hi, I'm Deborah Kale Earnshaw, and my poem for Extinction Radio this week is called Enjoy the Universe. It's by Emily. The sparrow sings in the morning, and though he weaves through the trees, his song is not forgotten. But it slips into the falling petals of the dogwood trees. Enjoy the universe. Enjoy each passing moment that flits by like a wounded butterfly. Don't reach out, don't touch it, just let it slip away. To watch it die is the only way to assure its life. Its wings are too fragile, and they beat so fast. But it doesn't last. This place, it doesn't last. Enjoy the universe. Enjoy every little thing you have, because it will be gone faster than you can recognize its value. Enjoy the universe, every little bit that you see, because you will never see it all. And take your boat with a splintered mast and tattered sails and push it out to sea. And rejoice, even if it should break, rejoice. Because you know how to swim. Enjoy the universe and do nothing else. The sparrow sings in the morning, and though he weaves through the trees, his song is not forgotten.
Thank you for that beautiful poetry reading. Now John Campos Cosham, we'll give a review of a movie about the founding of Greenpeace that he saw recently. John?
Hello there in Extinction Radio Land. It's John Campos Cosham here in York, UK. Now, this week I'd like to tell you about a film premiere that I went to, and I am recommending you go and see this film. It's called How to Change the World, and it's about the start of the pressure group Greenpeace. The film is made up mainly of clips from the huge Greenpeace vault in Amsterdam of all the film and audio that they took in the early 1970s, plus interviews with the remaining characters from Greenpeace in the modern day. So you see clips of them back in the 1970s, and then interviews with them as old people. It is very good. Greenpeace started when a bunch of hippies in Vancouver decided that they were very unhappy at the Umchukka nuclear testing going on in Alaska, where the US was testing out nuclear bombs. So they hired an old fishing boat and they tried to get out there and stop the testing. Now, they didn't succeed. The testing went ahead and they couldn't get there because of red tape and weather. And they came back feeling dejected because they thought they'd failed. But because it had been in the media, they came back as heroes, and they were welcomed back into Vancouver, and they couldn't believe how people thought they'd been successful. But they had been successful because they had got the test into the media, and the objections to the test had got airtime. So this was the start of what Greenpeace do big time now. The next thing they did was they had this mad idea of Save the Whales. So a lot of the film is of their attempts to find the Russian whaling fleet, and the very first time they put the rubber dinghies between the harpoon and the whale. And they had some pretty media-savvy people, so there were people filming what was happening, and fortunately they got a shot of the harpoon going 15 foot above the heads of the people in the rubber dinghy, and that got onto national news, and it helped Greenpeace get started. Now, like any organisation, there are plenty of internal politics, and organisations have people in them, and people sometimes don't get on and have different views. So, for me, this film was really interesting. I'm not actually a member of Greenpeace, and never have been, although I appreciate what they do enormously. I think it's really interesting because I've been a member of lots of organisations where people have had disagreements, they've had different priorities, this is a major part of the film, actually looking at people going off and doing their own thing in the name of the Greenpeace organisation, and a satellite Greenpeace organisation starting up, and the first one wanting to retain control of the name, and the beginning of Greenpeace International, and that how that helped. All in all, it's a really well-balanced film. As an activist, I recognised lots of things, you know, the kind of hippie activist types, of which I am definitely one, and their passion and their drive, and also their failings, of which I have many too. So I cried during the film. It was moving. It was exciting. It was like a little window in on the past, with the lovely 60s music and the hippies with flowers in their hair dancing around raising money for Greenpeace. So it opened on Friday to the general public. It'll be in a cinema near you. Go and see it in the cinema with some friends. It's well worth it. That's How to Change the World. And go and change the world.
Thank you, John. Now another one of my gems, the band Stolen Thief, The Postman.
Something in your mind you cannot hide. You can try everything, you'll be high in the end. But there's something on your cheek that's flowing like a creek.
tears are their tears, or just dying memories. Keep doing what you do, remember that anyway. You are the stolen thief. Keep seeing what you say. Dress, but look better around you. There's nothing but your lies. You're lost in your mind without no compass. You can try to pinch yourself and wake up fast. Keep doing what you do, but remember that anyway, you are the stolen thief. But remember that everywhere, you'll be the stolen thief. You'll be the stolen thief. You'll be the stolen thief. You'll be the stolen thief, my friend. Keep doing what you do, but remember that anyway, you are the stolen thief. And keep saying what you say, but remember that anyway, you'll be the stolen thief. You'll be the stolen thief. You'll be the stolen thief. You'll be the stolen thief, my friend.
Hee-haw, it's Benjamin the Donkey. Are you familiar with the famous long poem, The Rubaiyat of Dumur Khayyam? Here are a few verses. The finger writes, and having writ, allows you to read your obit. Doom gives you the finger, and says you won't linger much longer in all of this shit. That bowl which we call the sky is a covering lid they apply, whereunder we crawl to the petri dish wall, then run out of food and die. The Big Bang determined the text, which we read, yet still get perplexed. The way it exploded, right then encoded, whatever you're going to do next. Hee-haw!
And now it's time for Carolyn Baker, one of our co-hosts, to talk about beauty. Beauty is the most important thing in the world for me. No matter how bad it is, you can still find beauty somewhere. Carolyn Baker talking about beauty.
Hello, all of you Extinction Radio fans. Today, I'd like to talk about beauty. And back in 2009, I wrote a book called Sacred Demise, Walking the Spiritual Path of Industrial Civilization's Collapse. I devoted an entire chapter in that book to beauty, and I called the chapter Beauty, the Gift That Visits and Vanishes. Now, back in those days, I knew a lot less about abrupt climate change, catastrophic climate change, than I know today. So I was thinking mostly in terms of the collapse of industrial civilization, but in terms of the collapse of anything, civilization, ecosystems, whatever, it's really important that we are able to appreciate and create beauty. You see, many of the avenues of beauty on which we've relied in the past to grace our five physical senses with extraordinary sights and sounds, smells, tastes, and textures are probably going to be less accessible or completely inaccessible in the future. Consequently, it's going to be necessary to acquire beauty more consciously in less likely places and with more intention. And yet, in the ugliest of circumstances, beauty may be found. Even concentration camp inmates during the Holocaust were able to find some beauty. There were some people like Fania Fenelon and the Musicians of Auschwitz, that was actually the name of their group. They had access to musical instruments as depicted in the 1980 television movie, Playing for Time. Other people in the camps had to secretly create makeshift instruments or drawings or sing along in groups secretly or in some other way. And yet, by whatever means they created beauty, it added to the meaning, which Viktor Frankl wrote about in his wonderful book, Man's Search for Meaning, and it nurtured the mind and emotions when no other solace could be found. In terms of our future, we can't know the extent to which energy depletion will prevent us from hearing beautiful music on the radio or CD players, MP3s, computers. Musical instruments, though, should be included in our preparation for the future, especially drums, which are so intimately connected with nature. Now, in preparation for the future, we can savor the myriad forms of beauty in our lives and cherish them with utmost reverence and honor, aware that they will not always be with us. As the 70s singer and composer Carly Simon wrote, "These are the good old days." It may be that in a few years, a delicious meal like the one that a friend may have just cooked and that we consumed with gusto may not be available. And what is more, our friend may not be present with us. The cozy, warm, soft bed in which we sleep tonight may not be the place where we are forced to sleep in a different kind of world. Many people, creatures, necessities, and amenities that we now enjoy may not grace our lives and our homes in years to come. Now is the time to revel in their presence and their presence in our lives. Now is the time to delight in every moment of beauty, joy, love, conviviality, playfulness, intimacy, sensuality, and fullness of life with which we are graced in these present moments. As many of you know, I love the poet Mary Oliver, and in her poem, The Messenger, she speaks so beautifully to what our real job is right now. She says, "My work is loving the world. Here the sunflowers, there the hummingbird, equal seekers of sweetness. Here the quickening yeast, there the blue plums, here the clam deep in the speckled sand. Are my boots old? Is my coat torn? Am I no longer young and still not half perfect? Let me keep my mind on what matters, which is my work, which is mostly standing still and learning to be astonished. The Phoebe, the delphinium, the sheep in the pasture and the pasture, which is mostly rejoicing, since all ingredients are here, which is gratitude to be given a mind and a heart and these body clothes, a mouth with which to give shouts of joy to the moth and the wren, to the sleepy dug-up clam, telling them all over and over how it is that we live forever." No, she doesn't mean that we're going to live forever. What she's talking about is that eternal essence that is in all beauty, that makes things beautiful. We can touch that eternity every time we savor, or create beauty. That is our work in the world.
Ivy Cohn here with this week's extreme weather update. More than 100,000 flee floods in Japan after a once in 50 years rain. Unprecedented rain in Japan unleashed heavy floods on Friday that tore houses from their foundations, uprooted trees, and forced more than 100,000 people from their homes. Helicopters hovering over swirling, muddy waters rescued many people from the roofs of their homes. 7 people were missing, and at least 17 were injured. Some areas received double the usual September rainfall in 48 hours after tropical storm Ito swept across Japan's main island. Lightning, thunderstorms, hail, extreme heat hit Southern California in the United States. While most of Southern California experienced extreme heat on Wednesday, some areas were also battered by the kind of wild weather that was blamed for the death of at least one person the previous day. Triple-digit highs were also expected in the valley areas of San Bernardino and Riverside counties, prompting weather services to issue a heat advisory for the region. Meanwhile, monsoonal moisture was expected to bring more thunderstorms to the mountain and desert areas. The storms were capable of producing locally heavy rainfall and flash flooding, along with mud and debris flows in recent wildfire burn areas. The extreme heat in Southern California also caused severe power outages, with thousands of residents across the region waking up without power on last Thursday. Baseball-sized hail came smashing down near Naples, Italy, last Saturday in a storm that injured several people and animals, in addition to causing damage to vehicles, crops, and more. Baseball-sized hailstones fall from thunderstorms at speeds of at least 75 miles per hour, so it's no wonder you can see the magnitude of smashed windshields and structural damage. Across Europe, last week there were 15 tornadoes, 7 severe windstorms, 10 large hailstorms, 21 heavy rainstorms, and 4 incidences of damaging lightning. The massive dust storm that enveloped much of the Middle East on Tuesday sent Jeddah into total darkness at 6 p.m. The storm lasted for 40 minutes, with sand-laden winds so ferocious that one could hear the incessant rattlings of windows in many neighborhoods. The rain in Spain claims lives of 4 and causes chaos across South Coast. Torrential rain caused massive flooding, closed roads, and washed away vehicles across Spain's southern coast region and claimed the lives of 4 people in Andalusia. The South American spring outlook is rain to deluge Argentina, southeast Brazil. A stormy weather pattern will prevail through most of September across much of southern South America. However, some areas that are in need of rain can expect dry weather to persist the next several months. Needed rain in north-central Chile, including Santiago, will fade quickly through the fall season, while areas farther south will have a wet season. The active weather in Chile will translate to rounds of rain and occasional severe weather in northeastern Argentina, Uruguay, and southeastern Brazil. Meanwhile, the northern two-thirds of Brazil will continue to receive below normal rainfall as the drought continues. Short and sweet, that's this week's extreme weather update. The only thing I didn't mention is the storms churning around in the Arctic, moving that remaining slushy ice out of the area to make way for hot water incoming from all directions. Have a great day. Until next time, I'm Ivy Cohn.
Here's another Q&A session by Dr. Guy McPherson. Every Monday, I ask the members of Near Term Human Extinction, a support group on Facebook, to pose a question to Dr. McPherson. Here's this week's questions and answers by Guy. Guy?
Benjamin the Donkey asks, how come, in your opinion, and preferably from a sociological perspective, that within our previously more unified Doomer community, there's people getting all pissed off at each other lately? Well, I think what we're seeing is the twin consequences of an empire in decline as more people lose their jobs and are unable to keep up financially with the kinds of things they used to have ready access to in their lives. And then there's the other side of the fossil fuel coin. It's becoming increasingly apparent that we're in the midst of abrupt climate change. And so people are stressed as a result. That's my best guess from an ill-informed sociological perspective. Amy Lynn asks, what would be the ideal global plan for climate migration? I don't think there is such a plan that would be in any way ideal. I think we don't have long left. I think what we're seeing is refugees all over the globe at this point, not migrating, not planning to stay for a few days or a few years, but trying to escape the lack of habitat where they used to live. G. Frank Lott asked, do you plan on moving your home base to a location further north within the next 10 years? No. Quinn Taylor asks, is there a plan for an NTHE intentional community somewhere? And if not, is it a realistic idea? I don't know of any such plan, and I have no comment on whether it's a realistic idea. If somebody wants to pursue that, to create an intentional community based on the concept of near-term human extinction, and can find like-minded people, go for it. Teresa Yeager asks, what are you doing to prepare yourself emotionally for our NTHE? Well, I'm preparing myself emotionally for my own personal death, and I've been doing that for a long time. How do I do that? Embracing reality and meditating occasionally. Bruce Engel asks, how long would you think the horrors committed by mankind towards mankind due to climate stress will continue until our numbers become so few that that kind of behavior will begin to diminish? How quickly may the majority of the human species die off? Wow. Well, the majority, in fact, we may lose habitat for all individuals of our species in a matter of a few weeks to a few years as a result of collapse of industrial civilization and the consequent very abrupt rise in temperature associated with that. So at that point, we won't have to worry about the horrors committed by mankind towards mankind or even humankind towards human unkind. John Compost Cossum asks, what is your favorite crop you've picked in the last week? That would be the raspberries I picked from the shelf of the grocery store yesterday.
That's a lot easier than the 4 bushels of tomatoes I picked from my garden and processed into puree and tomato soup this week. I've got about another 3 or 4 bushels left that are now ripening. It's been a very cool summer, and all the crops are late. Anyway, thank you, Guy. I look forward to next week's episode. And now, on Extinction Radio, we have Deba Kale Earnshaw reading the latest dispatch from Sam Karana. Deba?
Hi, it's Deba Kale Earnshaw here with Sam Karana's article this week entitled, Will It Be 3.27 Degrees Celsius Warmer by the Year 2030? In December 2015, world delegates will descend on Paris to ensure that global warming will not cross the guardrail of 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. In a way, we have already crossed this guardrail. According to NOAA data, the year-to-date land surface temperature was 1.47 degrees Celsius above the 20th century average on the Northern Hemisphere. Granted, there was less warming on the Southern Hemisphere, that is 1.34 degrees Celsius, but that's a small difference, especially since most people live in the Northern Hemisphere. More importantly, This 1.47 degrees Celsius rise is a rise compared to the 20th century average. The 20th century average was some 0.60 degrees Celsius higher than temperatures were at the start of the NOAA record in 1880. In other words, temperatures for most people on Earth are already 2.07 degrees Celsius higher than they were in 1880. Furthermore, between 1750 and 1880, the global average temperature had already increased by some 0.20 degrees Celsius. Sure, 2015 is an El Niño year, but this El Niño is still strengthening, so 2016 looks set to be even warmer. Moreover, recent temperatures are in line with expectations of a polynomial trend line that is based on these NOAA data, and that points at yet another degree Celsius rise by 2030, on top of the current level. Altogether, this would make it 3.27 degrees Celsius warmer than in 1750 for most people on Earth by the year 2030. So instead of acting as if dangerous global warming could possibly eventuate beyond the year 2100, delegates in Paris should commit to lowering temperatures starting now. To lower temperatures, cutting emissions alone will not be enough. Stopping all emissions by people would make the aerosols that are currently sent up in the air by burning fuel and are currently masking the full impact of global warming will fall out of the air in a matter of weeks. Furthermore, carbon dioxide that is emitted now will take 10 years to reach its peak impact. So we're still waiting the full wrath of carbon dioxide emitted over the last decade. A recent study calculates that global mean surface temperature may increase by 0.5 degrees Celsius after carbon emissions are stopped, and they will have decreased only minimally from that level for the next 10,000 years. Removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere would not work fast enough to avoid further warming and acidification of the oceans. In fact, temperatures look set to rise even faster as feedbacks start to kick in more fully, such as albedo changes due to decline of the snow and ice cover in the Arctic, and methane releases from the Arctic Ocean sea floor. In conclusion, the world needs to commit to comprehensive and effective action that includes both emission cuts and removal of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere and oceans, as well as further action to deal with the dire situation in the Arctic, as discussed at the Arctic News blog.
Here's another one of his updates on climate change, Dr. Guy McPherson. Guy?
My ability to provide an update about abrupt climate change has been interrupted by a combination of personal disruptions and personal laziness. I know Shakova and Samelatov have published a new paper, and I know about the September 7th, 2015 overview in the Washington Post. I just haven't taken the time to look closely at either paper. But I'd be remiss if I failed to mention climate refugees all over the globe. Even the mainstream media are picking up this story, although they tend to focus incorrectly on labeling the refugees as migrants or immigrants, implying they're merely passing through and will be leaving soon. They're refugees with no place to call home. Their homes have been destroyed by climate change. This is happening with about a 1 degree Celsius rise in global average temperature. Deniers of abrupt climate change ought to remind me how a 4C rise in global average temperature is going to work out just fine for us.
Thank you, Guy. And that's the conclusion of another episode of Extinction Radio, podcast episode 25. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Peter Melton, Ivy Cohn, and Carolyn Baker, for making this happen. And then a final shout out to Mike Farragan, whose vision made this all possible. Thank you all. Look forward till next week.